rank in the medical school, and his PhD is in behavior genetics and differential psychology. Somebody had the bright idea of Hollywooding this course, as I have just passed my 69th birthday, and they maybe thought I'd have a coronary and be dead shortly. In any case, I retire after next year, so the idea was to get Regents Professor Meehl down in Tablets of Jade, which I hope is not going to inhibit me. I'll try to be as freewheeling as I normally am, although one has the thought, I hate to say something stupid that goes down in the record to this extent. One of the graduate students raised the question whether you would be inhibited, since this is a mixed lecture and seminar format, from asking questions if you thought the camera was going to turn on you. And the crew will do whatever we want. So let's have a show of hands. How many are willing that they go on camera if they talk? And how many don't want to? Well, that's darn near even. Let's have more votes. How many are willing to be cameraed while you're talking? Eight, 10, 11, 12. All right, how many are definitely unwilling? Well, I'll leave it to the producer then, whether he wants to spot that people are unwilling, or otherwise we'll just go democratically and everybody opens his mouth is taking a chance that you'll go on camera. This is a funny course. There are no exams. There are no term papers. You are on your honor to show up unless you're sick. My theory is that we ought to have at least one course at the graduate level where there's no sword of Damocles over the student's head, the way it used to be in the old days in Vienna. The only sword was your PhD oral. Which was kind of hard on some people because they never got a chance to assess themselves until then. I asked my old pal Herbert Feigl, who was PhD philosophy of Vienna in the 20s. I said, well, surely there must have been some people. There are no written exams. They don't give mid-quarters, you know. Some people who flunked the final oral, and he said, oh, yes, yes, many of them suicided. So at least you have, in this crazy American system of higher education where at the graduate level we put exams in as if you were undergraduate bobby soxers, and then we hit you with a written and oral prelim and a final oral both, so you get the worst of all worlds. Well, in this course, you can be relaxed about everything except the concepts, because nobody's going to grade you. We'll put in an S rather than an N. If there is someone here who needs to have a letter grade, A or B, come to see me in my office hour and we'll talk about a way to do it. Although I should warn you that when I do give grades, I am somewhat anal retentive about giving A's. That is, I have old-fashioned pre-World War II criteria for an A in the graduate school, so I should warn you of that. Let's see. I'm going to pass out a publication list, not to snow you with Meehl's somewhat excessive writings on occasion, but I find it very handy to be able to say, see my publication number 7, instead of getting up to the blackboard and writing down the site to the journal and all of that stuff. And I mainly hang out in the medical school rather than in this building, so that's where I keep reprints. If you want any reprints of my writings, just go over to my medical school office, which is room 682 Deal Hall. That's the top floor of the biomedical library. And My name is on the door together with Lickens, and the secretary is right in front of them when you come in, and tell her you're from this class, and you can go and take any reprints that you want. And if there are any that are exhausted, she has a master file, and that means she will sign either she will Xerox it for you, or if she's busy, she'll sign it out. You'll sign your name in blood, and they'll kill you if you don't bring it back. I think anything you might want to read except some long chapter in a book will be available in that way. My office hours in this building are at 12:30 to 2 before this class on Thursdays, which is an open time, first come, first served. And if you don't want to take a chance of cooling your heels, why then call my secretary at 65029, which is my medical school office, and tell her you want to make an appointment, because that's where I check in regularly. Her name is Marcia Smith. The format here is a mixture of lecture and discussion, as much discussion as you want. And classes have varied widely from one year to another. And if I get people who are sort of docile and passive or who are intimidated, why, I just talk, which is fine. I don't mind that. On the other hand, some students find it more exciting if the class gets into the act, and you should feel free to do that. I am, I have strong views on certain methodological points, but I'm not a dogmatic fella despite the strong views, and I don't think that I'm the least bit threatened or discombobulated if a student points out that I committed a fallacy or that I don't know a certain important fact. So that's up to you, how much discussion we have. It just varies, and you will determine that. Now, I'll give you a little summary because what we're going to do, because I've learned by experience that there's a big drop-off after the second or third week when people decide this is not their dish of tea. And that's understandable because the title Philosophical Psychology is not very informative. So I'll tell you what we're going to do. First of all, what we're not going to do. The title Philosophical Psychology sometimes suggests to students that we will go into those deep philosophical questions about determinism and freedom, moral responsibility, if determinism is true, the criminal law in that respect, the mind-body problem, the great problems of philosophy, is the mind a spin-off from the brain, or is it identical with the brain events, or if it's a spin-off, is it epiphenomenal without causal efficacy, or does it act back upon the brain as the interactionists like Descartes believed? And those are fascinating questions. I'm very much interested in them myself. I don't dismiss them the way most psychologists do, as meaningless or silly to talk about. And I have published both of those subjects, determinism and the mind-body problem, in philosophy journals. But psychology students are usually not the least bit interested in those problems, and so we don't do it in this course. And if you personally have a big interest in the mind-body problem or in freedom of will and determinism and so forth, come to talk to me about it. But it really isn't appropriate in the class, because the consensus has invariably been that it's not what most people like to hear about. So what is it if it's not that stuff? Well, it's Meal's version of meta-theory for psych students. That's the way you could characterize it. Meal's version of meta-theory for psych students. And by meta-theory, I mean the empirical theory of theory. I wouldn't have said that 10 years ago because I hadn't been converted to the new view. But meta-theory is the empirical theory of scientific theory, but the fact that it's an empirical theory does not preclude it from using formal armchair arguments. That's the crux of the position as I now see it. The empirical theory of decision-making in economics is not precluded from employing the probability calculus, for instance. The empirical theory of rat vision is not precluded from using geometry. And similarly, the empirical theory of scientific theory is not precluded from talking about set theory, probability theory, inductive logic, and so forth. Now, that's not the kind of philosophy of science I was raised on. I entered graduate school in 1941, And logical positivism was still the dominant view of how things were. And while I was not a dogmatic positivist, I was a 95% one, as most of us were in those days. And in that tradition, very little attention was paid to the empirical facts of the history of knowledge. I won't say that they ignored it, but they paid very little attention to it. The idea in those days was that you could do philosophy of science pretty much from the armchair, the way, say, Immanuel Kant or Descartes or Hume did it. And that being so, these people, the great positivists, and I'll talk some about them today, these people used certain very familiar standard window-dressed examples. And so when you took a course in philosophy of science, you heard about Einstein and the eclipse, you heard about Kepler, you heard about Newton, you heard about Darwin, although not as much, you heard about the kinetic theory of heat, you heard maybe about the beginning of quantum mechanics, and those were the standard examples. Very little from the life sciences, not as much from chemistry as from physics and astronomy, and almost nothing of the embarrassing episodes in the history of science. And so you got kind of an automatic truth-grinding machine view of how it goes, or what Feyerabend sarcastically calls the layer cake theory of knowledge. I mean, here's the facts, then we have logic and mathematics, and we put that on top of the facts, and then we got this theory, and this is all operationally defined. That was a sacred word when I was a graduate student, operationism. And that's how it goes. And if people are rational rather than irrational, and if they're unprejudiced rather than bigoted, they will arrive at the truth. That the only source of error, as Karl Popper somewhere says, is the conspiracy theory. You are only making mistakes if you fall for one of Bacon's idols. And if you're not poisoned by your politics or by your religion or by your social class or your sex or your age or whatever, if you're not poisoned and if you don't have dirty glasses, why then you look at the empirical world and you collect these protocols and then you apply the instrumentation of mathematics, maybe in social sciences a lot of statistics, and out of that truth will emerge. Now I am parodying it a little bit. These men were not dummies. The positivists were not dummies, and it irritates me when I read some of the younger generation writing about people like Carnap as if he could barely tie his shoes. But the fact is they did have a simplistic idea of how science went. And they had that for a couple of reasons. Number one, that they thought it was a purely a priori enterprise, so you didn't have to look at the history. You picked historical examples for illustrative purposes, like for teaching purposes. You didn't sample the history of science to try to draw generalizations about how it went. You picked your examples to illustrate points, and that's why the same old ones like phlogiston and caloric and kinetic theory kept coming up. And the other part of it was that these guys were very much afraid of seeming to tromp on the scientists' turf. They were almost phobic about not prescribing for the empirical sciences. They didn't want to be in the position of a nut like Hegel, who claimed to prove, apparently, a priori, there couldn't be more than seven planets. I may be unfair to him, but I've been told that by people who know. They wanted to be sure that the scientists wouldn't have cause to complain about what they were up to. And these people were, with very few exceptions, trained in the sciences, chemistry, physics. Some of them had advanced degrees, and all of them had some undergraduate courses in those areas. My friend Herbert Feigl, recently deceased, that ran the Philosophy of Science Center here for many years, Vienna, PhD, had a PhD equivalent in chemistry, although his actual degree was in philosophy. So they had a great respect for the sciences, and they didn't want to be in the role of some goofy philosopher who sits in his study and tells the chemist how things are. And that's understandable. That's a goofy role to be in. I mean, that was done for several centuries, wasn't it, by philosophers and theologians and the like. Well, if you got that phobia For heaven's sake, let's not pontificate to the chemist. He knows what he's doing in the lab. If you don't play very much of the history, then what is it that your enterprise really consists of? What is it that you're doing? And their definition of it was the logical reconstruction of science. The logical reconstruction of science. In other words, the chemist and the physicist and the geneticist comes to us, the philosopher of science, and he puts his stuff on the table, and he says, this is the way the world is, as far as we figured it out. And then we, the logician and philosopher of science, we look at this and we see how we can reconstruct it. Well, I prefer the term meta-theory, as many people are coming to, because it has the connotation of a theory of theories, and in that respect, it sort of dissociates itself from the term philosophy of science, which is in rather bad odor with some scientists. I mean, there are scientists who pay attention to it, like Eccles and Medawar and so on, but there are a lot of scientists, including some eminent ones I know on this faculty, Regents Professor Nye and physics, he just poo-poos it. He can't figure out. He thinks I'm a pretty smart fella, and so he tells me he can't figure out why Mill would waste his time on something like philosophy of science, which is a complete fraud in his view. Well, then what will this course do for you, other than if it's fun, which is really what it's for? I mean, it's not fun. If you're not having fun, you might as well be dead. You know, that's one of the basic principles. I mean that. That's my philosophy of life, along with a dash of Buddhism and Albert Ellis. So if you're not having fun, you might as well be dead. What good is a PhD if it's not fun? So that's the main thing about this course. And I usually have fun in here. But what will it do as, let us say, a means to an end of further fun for you, an instrumental kind of fun? Well, it won't help you invent theories, and it will not help you to design clever experiments. So if that's what you're here for, you're deceiving yourself. It may help you on occasion to analyze your data, especially if you're in an area where what you have is mostly tests of significance, since we're going to spend most of this quarter beating up on their abuse. It may at times help you to criticize theories, your own and other people's. And it will probably help you to fend off dumb objections to your ideas. Social scientists are the most methodologically obsessed of any of the disciplines, much more than biological scientists. Physical scientists hardly at all, except when they run into something like the two-slit paradox in quantum mechanics. That makes them nervous. But most of the time, they don't methodologize very much. They get on with the business. Psychologists and sociologists, my impression is sociologists are even worse than we are, methodologize and obsess about definitions, for instance, and whether they've got true operational definitions, blah, blah, blah. Giving explicit verbal definitions, incidentally, is one of the least important things that the powerful sciences do, as you know if you've taken courses in physics and chemistry and genetics. Verbal definitions, that's not where the power of physics and astronomy come from. The power of physics and astronomy and chemistry and genetics comes, A, from the instruments of observation and control, B, from the mathematics. And the idea that you can make sociology into hotsy-totsy science by writing a paragraph that's operational verbal definition is a delusion. But there is a tendency in our field to beat up on the opposition by philosophical arguments. It is not, I think, as bad today as when I was your age. But even when I was in my 40s, it was still being done. People, for example, who had been raised on associationism as their view of, say, verbal behavior, and then realized that it didn't quite work, and were influenced by Chomsky, proceeded to beat up the old associationists like Fred Skinner and the Hullians and the Neo-Hullians and Charlie Osgood and company, by philosophical arguments, or by quoting Thomas Kuhn's book on scientific revolutions. Well, now that's a question-begging enterprise, to quote Kuhn, because all you're saying there is that Kuhn has shown that sometimes you should drop your paradigm and use a different one, but that leaves it quite open whether the paradigm you're currently using is or isn't in bad trouble. I mean, that's a meta-argument, and you have to deal with that argument on the merits. I happen to agree with the Chomskyites against the associationists, but that's beside the point, what I believe there. It was an illicit use of a history of science a kind of evidence. And the Hullians, which was the dominant theory when I was in graduate school, and in my early research in learning, animal learning with McCorkadale, all of the research I did was on one single kind of problem, latent learning, because that was the focus of the disagreement between the cognitive people, the rat cognitive people, which meant Tolman and Leeper, and the SR people, which meant Skinner, Hull, and Guthrie. Although Skinner didn't give a damn about latent learning and wouldn't talk about it. But the Hullians felt that they had to explain it. And they had a heck of a time doing so. Well, in those days, one of the main ways that the Hullians, and the Iowa Hullians were the worst sinners in this regard, they were the worst. Spence was terrible in this respect. Spence is a smart man, and I liked him a lot, and we got along fine, but he was terrible in this respect. They were always beating up on the Tolmanites, and more broadly, the cognitive type rat psychologists, by saying that maybe Hull's theory is false, but at least it fits philosophy of science, meaning that it had operational definitions throughout, and it had mathematical equations, which were pretentious, and Tolman knew he didn't have that much math, so he didn't pretend to, whereas Hull made a mistake. He had his friend Perkins fitting these damn growth functions to 3 points with 3 parameters, you know. Well, I could go on with that, but I won't. Yeah, I'll talk about that later. All right, so it should, the course can have for you a kind of prophylactic value that it will, I hope, protect you from falling into silly philosophy of science reasoning, and it will fend off your roommate if your roommate is trying to beat up on your preferred theory by philosophical arguments. The philosophy of science, which is generally peddled in beginning psychology courses, is roughly half a century out of date. I picked the value 50 years. It's now over that. Because you could say that the strict operationism that is preached still in beginning psych and soc courses went out, so far as the logicians are concerned, with the publication in 1935 or 6 of Carnap's classic paper called Testability and Meaning. I am unaware of any logician or philosopher of science who's held to strict operationism since Carnap wrote that paper, 1936. That doesn't mean, God forbid, that I'm against all operational definitions. You have to have a subset of definitions in any science that are. We'll talk about that at length. Some people would say ad nauseam. A subset of the concepts have to be operationally defined, otherwise your theory doesn't connect with the facts. But it's a proper subset, and the most powerful theoretical constructs in sciences are frequently not susceptible of a direct operational definition, but are related to the facts only by a long, complex, and sometimes stochastic chain. That will say a lot about it. You'll get tired of seeing the nomological net on the blackboard before the course is over. You should be aware in this connection that even psychologists who do not like to talk about philosophy of science in its own jargon, and that's okay. I have never said that students should learn philosophy of science. Students sometimes, knowing my interest in the area, I've had graduate students come to see me about being their advisor and say, I presume you'd like me to minor in the philosophy department. And I say, hell no, learn computer programming. Or take some biochemistry. And they say, well, I assumed that Meal would want me, blah, blah. And I say, no, you can do that. You can take my course with Licken. and maybe read the following set of books, and that's the only amount of philosophy of science you need to know if you're a methodologically oriented person. With me, it's a hobby, almost a major interest. I almost shifted when I was an undergraduate. They offered me a TA-ship in the philosophy department, and I damn near took it. I'm glad I didn't, but that's how strong my passions are along those lines, and I don't expect you to share those. And so, for some of you, this is fun because you have an interest in methodology, and for the others, I hope it'll be fun and useful for these reasons, as prophylaxis and defense, and maybe to wash out, if you did get some simplistic philosophy of science in psych or soc 1-2, I hope to cure you of that disease. Well, I didn't finish a sentence there. Much of the, despite the psychologists who don't like to talk about philosophy of science in its terminology, if you do a content analysis of scientific papers, even in journals like the Journal of Experimental, it turns out that a large percentage of the sentences that you find in those papers are methodological remarks. Practically any experimental paper contains a few, some contain a lot, and theoretical papers contain more methodological remarks than they do factual remarks. By a methodological remark, I mean a remark in the meta language rather than the object language of a science. Now, the object language of a science is the language that speaks about its subject matter, the entities that science investigates. It doesn't necessarily mean observable objects. It can be theoretical objects as well, like protons or libido or habit strength. So that examples of terms that occur in the object language of a science would be the word atom, or the word field, or the Hullian term habit strength, or Skinner's rate. Rate is not quite operationally strength in Skinner, as you, I assume, know. Close to it, but not quite. Freud's term libido. The psychometrist's term G, the general intelligence factor. The clinician's word schizophrene. The term reinforce. Any of the names of chemicals in chemistry? All right, these are all object language terms. The adjectives are object linguistic. They're all object language terms. So that means that they're, in the logician's sense, descriptive terms. The way the logicians use that word is unfortunately not the way we do. We usually mean by descriptive something that you can say this is white or that this feels hard. For the logician, all of these words in the object language are descriptors. Whereas in the meta-language, the subject matter is not the material objects of our science, but the statements that occur in our science and the relations between them. Properties of statements and relations between statements are meta-language. So that these are examples of words that occur in the meta-language. True. False. If you have a phobia of the word true, I'm going to cure you of that too. You'll be quite relaxed about saying things are true. The phrase confirmed by data. The term rational. The term unknown. The term fallacious. The term derivable or deducible. The term valid. The term probable. All of these are metalinguistic words. They refer to the relations between statements or sentences or propositions, or if you want to speak psychologically, the relation between beliefs, between one belief and another, and the relationship between beliefs and evidence. Now, of course, I can investigate the relationship between beliefs and evidence causally. And if I'm a psychologist or a sociologist, I might be doing that. So there is a little fuzzing up of the meta-language, object-language distinction in the social sciences, but let us put that one aside for the time being. I mean, it arises because of the fact that in the social sciences, we study cognizing entities, namely people or rats. Whereas, as Carnap used to say, this stone is thinking of Vienna is a meaningless proposition, even if you're not a positivist. So only those subject matters that involve cognition as something that the specimen is capable of engaging in present you with this special problem. If I'm a linguist studying the theology of the Hogobogo, how do I make this distinction clean between object language and meta-language propositions? And that is a fuzzed up area. But for our purposes in this class, it is usually tolerably clear whether we're in the object language or in the meta-language. So object linguistic statements are about the subject of the science. Meta-linguistic statements are about the science, if you like, about the propositions of the scientist, about the beliefs of the scientist, about the relationship between sets of beliefs, and so on. I listed probable in the meta-language. We're going to retract that later. But for now, let me say that the word probable also appears in the object language in certain disciplines, including ours. And that suggests that there are two meanings of the word probable, an argument which has now been going on for, I believe, over 100 years. Whether the word probable in the object language, as when we say it is not probable that Meal will be alive 20 years hence, is a different use of the word probable from the evolution theory is probable on the fossil data. Different use. One is about a physical event, the death of a person, and the other is about the relationship between statements about fossils and Darwin's statements about evolution. Probable is a fuzzy one. Another way then you could summarize what the class is about is concepts, theories, and how we appraise them. Concepts, theories, and how we appraise them. Now, in order to help you decide whether you want to stick around, I will also pass out some propaganda of mine. Theoretical risks and tabular asterisks. Which expresses my views as of 78? And so I am not completely senile. Since senility produces rigidity, I have changed my mind on certain important points in that paper since 1978. The core ideas I consider to be sound, if properly amended and qualified, but I think that I was somewhat overly Popperian in that paper. A paper criticizing me on that score has appeared in the American Psychologist a couple or 3 years ago by Serlin and Lapsley, to which I am writing a reply, but the reply begins by accepting the substance of their criticism. That is, I begin by saying, yes, they're right, I was too Popperian, and I didn't work my views about Lakatos into the paper. The reason for that was I didn't know how in 1978, and I now think that I do. But if you're familiar with the paper by Serlin and Lapsley attacking Meal, I can tell you, I'll say more about it later, but I'll tell you that essentially I agree with their criticism. I don't agree with their positive solution, but I do agree with their criticism of my own views. And then finally, a picture of what kind of stuff we talk about in here. A reading list. As I say, there are no assignments in this class. Those books, some of them may strike you as quite ancient, going back to Hans Reichenbach's 1938 Experience and Prediction. But, you know, even though philosophy of science changes, has changed a lot since I was a lad, there are certain core notions that are still around. And some of the older references in there explain those core notions. And the problem is that if you only start with the current, latest hot stuff, the writers ordinarily presuppose that you know the old stuff, and which puts you at a great disadvantage. I still recommend Reichenbach's 1938 to the people in the class. I reread it recently myself. It's a terrific book. Terribly smart man. Probably wrong about induction, but a terrific book. Awfully smart man. And anybody interested in epistemology and scientific theory, you do yourself a big favor by reading Hans Reichenbach, even if he was wrong about induction. Well, now let's do a little historical overview. Now, I know some people don't like to do history, and I'm not too fond of it myself. But I'm going to be talking about certain people and certain movements over and over again. And since I'm a little potty at my age, I tend to forget which things I talked about before. So I'd rather have all these people out to start with, and then we can refer back to them. I had a biometrics professor in this class helping to teach it some years ago, and he said to me once over a martini meal, "I don't understand why you were such a name dropper. You don't seem like that insecure, neurotic a man. How come you're such a name dropper?" Well, it turns out that he was offended because I mentioned some of these distinguished philosophers of science that I've known. Now, I don't see any point in dropping names. It's no credit to you if you know some famous person. Somebody wrote a whole book once, The Man Who Shook Hands with Coolidge, as I remember. And I don't drop these names because it shows something about me. How could it? The point is that in the Philosophy of Science Center here at Minnesota, of which I was one of the founders, we got enough money from Carnegie and Hill and Rockefeller to bring the most distinguished logicians and philosophers and historians of science in the world, not just in the United States, to come here to give lectures and sometimes to take a quarter leave or sometimes like Feyerabend for a whole academic year. And I felt very privileged as a non-philosopher to be able to talk with these guys whose stuff I had read and argue with them. And when I was a student, I always enjoyed hearing some anecdotes about famous people. I mean, when Bill Herron would talk about Tolman was a nice man and Hull was a nice man but not as nice as Tolman, and this affected Tolman's theory, which it no doubt did. I didn't ever meet Hull, but I knew Tolman slightly. And I look back and think of the difference between him and Spence, and I think it's no wonder that Tolman thought about the rat the way he did. That's the kind of fellow that he was. But it's not just that it's fun. Some of you may be bored by it. I always thought it was interesting to hear about these great characters when I was a graduate student. The other side of it is that even in science itself, excuse me, but especially in a sort of hazy area like meta-theory or philosophy of science, it often fills out your cognitive apprehension a bit to know what somebody said when pressed rather than what he said in his book. And I could give you lots of examples of that. I will content myself with only one, an anti-Kuhnian example. Paul K. Feyerabend, known generally in the philosophical circles as Madman Feyerabend, he is a little crazy. I don't know what the diagnosis would be, but he's a little crazy. A brilliant man, knows enough physics to have been a professor of physics, and is a philosopher of science professor at Berkeley, PhD, Vienna, and a student of Sir Karl Popper. And we'll talk a lot about Popper in this class. And Feyerabend, whom I know fairly well, I must have drunk 200 martinis with him, all told, over the years in the old Tempo Bar. Feyerabend has written at some length about the Kuhnian idea of the incommensurability of two different theories. He doesn't see it quite the way Kuhn sees it. And the fact that all alleged pure observations are theory-infected, and I'm sure those of you who have taken any courses in methodology are familiar with that argument. It's being very widely used in certain fields like social psych and even clinical these days. Taken from Kuhn, but also from people like Hansen, that all observational statements are infected with theory. Now, this is one of those widely held views which I think is false. But I understand why it's held, and it is true for certain disciplines, but it is not, in my opinion, true for psychology. The reason that it's true in the fields that Kuhn writes about, being an ex-physicist, is that in physics, astronomy, and parts of chemistry, the observational instruments employed are themselves subject to the laws that you are investigating. For example, you commonly, in nuclear physics, use one batch of elementary particles to study the others. And so that means that if there were some basic disagreement about some theorem of quantum mechanics or even about the theory of relativity, it would begin to be debatable whether you had actually caught this neutrino or whatever. So I don't dispute that. If I get into an argument with Thomas Kuhn about physics, we know who's going to lose, Meal. However, suppose I'm doing a T-maze experiment on latent learning, and I record that rat number 7, shown by where I've snipped his ears, turn right in the maze. Okay, you ask Feyerabend, now tell me, Paul, what the heck is theory infected about that? Well, he wouldn't pull the one that one of our graduate students pulled, in which he said in a final oral, well, it's infected with the theory of the continuity of bodies, namely that it's still the same rat it was last night. Who needs it? I mean, number one, that's a piece of common knowledge that you would hardly call even biological theory, and secondly, it's not in dispute, is it? I mean, it's not part of psychology. Whether macro objects with ears snipped in a certain way are the same rat tomorrow. I mean, what a crappy argument. But when I told Fire, I said, listen, you record how many rats went to the right goal box. If I got normal visual and hearing and I can tell right from left, what's theoretical about that? Oh, Fire Robin says, I only say that about cosmological theories. And I say, well, cosmological theories, what is that? And he says, well, look at my examples. Cosmological theories are theories that speak about everything. Well, now, that's a very important point, isn't it? Cosmological theories are theories that speak about everything. That is, anything that the chemist or physicist or astronomer studies is going to obey the Schrödinger equation, is going to obey the second law of thermodynamics, is going to obey the conservation laws, etc., etc., as far as we know. So that whether I'm studying how you heat this building or black holes, or the genetics of schizophrenia, I have to be careful that I don't violate the second law of thermodynamics and that I don't violate certain other pervasive principles. That's what Feyerabend means by a cosmological theory. All right? Thermodynamics, classical mechanics, relativity, quantum mechanics, blah, blah. Those are about chairs, neutrinos, nerve cells, everything. And so for that reason, all of the concepts that are called, quote, observational, when you use complicated apparatus like the physicist does, you know, he isn't around dropping cannonballs like Galileo these days, all of those things are theory infected in the way that Popper and Kuhn describe. I deny that all of the things that we study in animal learning, for example, are theory infected. Now, you might want to say, we'll go into more of that later, but you might want to say, well, come on, Meal, the fact that you're using a T-maze is affected by the theory you're testing. Oh, yes. No dispute that what you decide to do is affected by theory. What I'm complaining of is an argument that says the protocol you record is infected by the theory. And in fact, if it is, I would say you're a bad scientist if the protocol you record is infected by the theory. That you decide to look at this rather than that, that's theory infected. But when you decide what to look at, you better not put down that he turned right when he turned left, huh? Because of your theory. You know, it's like, outside of science, it's like being it's like a police detective. He's got a theory that Jones, the corpse, was murdered by his fellow officer, Smith, and therefore he was probably killed by a Smith & Wesson 38. Well, as theory may affect where he goes to look and all sorts of things, which underbrush and stuff like that. But if it turns out that the slug is from a Colt 45 and he records Smith & Wesson 38, we'd say he's a dishonest policeman, right? So that if an animal psychologist has a certain theory about rat learning and allows the theory to infect what he records in the protocol, we don't say that he's a brilliant theorist, we say he's a fake. Right? He's faking his data. Well, we'll have lots of other examples like that. It gets tenuous and feels like clinical and social. Very sticky. Very sticky. Psychoanalysis, on which I've written a long paper in there, that list, from my own experience, trying to say what parts of a psychoanalytic session could you say you had observed at a, quote, operational level. And that is plenty. That's one big mess. That is one big mess. And if you're pressed, the answer is what? Words, posture, and gestures, if you're pressed. Right? I mean, if I say, well, I observed the patient became more character armored as he was talking about this subject, you know, I'm looking at him, and somebody says, oh, don't give me that Reichian crap about character armor. I don't believe that stuff. Well, you should look the way I do. Your mind is poisoned, Emil. And that's when we get into that kind of a collision, brethren, it doesn't do any good to quote Thomas Kuhn. You get into that collision, somebody has to come in there with the cameras, huh, and photograph, and then we'll start measuring spots on the cheeks and so forth to get at the character armoring. Can't get away from it. If you really try to get away from that rock bottom thing, then you cut yourself loose from empiricism, which is all right. I mean, you want to be a metaphysician, be my guest, but you're not doing science anymore at that point. Well, let me talk some about some converging traditions that led to the present state of American behaviorism and neo-behaviorism. Very briefly, one can identify four big ones, and the first is pragmatism, which we connect mainly with the names of Dewey, William James, not that James was a behaviorist in the Skinner sense, but pragmatism with Dewey, William James, and Charles Saunders Peirce. That's P-E-I-R-C-E. Behaviorism proper, we connect, of course, first with John B. Watson. And some other of the great names there would be Tolman, Walter Hunter, Clark Hall, Guthrie, and now, of course, still living, the arch behaviorist of all, B. Frederick Skinner. I will have a lot to tell you about Skinner since he was here when I was a student. I came here as a freshman in 38, and he'd been here for a couple of years then, had just published his great book, and he left for Indiana the year I got my doctorate in 1945, and I spent hundreds of hours arguing with B.F. Skinner and had a great time at it. One of the smartest people I've ever met, and also, on certain topics, one of the most dogmatic. I used to resent that more than I do now. When I was a graduate student, it irritated me that he wouldn't talk about certain things. He just wouldn't talk about them, like latent learning. You know, you'd tell him about some Tolman experiment, and he'd say, he had a little tick, a shoulder tick. And Mike Elliott, the chairman, said to me, Neil, have you ever noticed Fred's tick? And I said, yeah, he goes like this. And Elliot said, well, I have a body language interpretation of that. I think he's shrugging off the facts. Well, and I would tell Skinner about some latent learning thing that Tolman had done, and Skinner would say, the maze is an unsatisfactory instrument for the study of behavior because it does not provide an instantaneous measure of the operant strength. And I would say, yes, Dr. Skinner, I know it doesn't give you an instantaneous measure of strength, and these dumbbells shouldn't have done that, but they did it, and this is what the little rats did. The maze is a totally unsatisfactory instrument for the study of behavior. You couldn't, I wanted to shake him. He's the same way about images. One time I really pressed him on the eidetic image, you know, where the kid counts the teeth off the image. If he's a good eidetiker, you show him a crocodile and you take it away and then you say, how many teeth? And the kid says, well, you didn't tell me to count them. Well, count them. 14. And he gets it right. Well, it's very plausible to say he's got something called an image that he's counting off of. Well, it's hard for Skinner to deal with that, so what did he do? He took his martini and walked away from me, so I don't know. Well, I tell you, I've become mellow on that kind of thing in my old age because in my youth this really irritated me, and I realize now that if you're as smart as Skinner and got that much going for you, you shouldn't waste your time answering everybody's arguments, despite Popper. It was far more important that B. Frederick Skinner did his thing than try to refute graduate student Mill. And the same thing is true of Freud. I think any of these really greats, it's just as the rest of us who are reasonably smart but not geniuses can pick around afterwards and clean it up. But it's important for Freud to do his thing and not worry about Adler, except to throw him out of the club. And it was important for Skinner to do his thing and to bring the changes on schedules and to move from the rat to the pigeon and all of that, rather than seeing, let's see, which parts of my doctrine could I translate into Hull? You know, some of us wanted him to do that. Who needs it? Why would you do that? Can't imagine why. All right. The great behaviorist said that, of course, there was the indirect impact from the Europeans on the behaviorist movement, notably Pavlov, and to a lesser extent, the other Russian, Bekhterev.
Can you go back to philosopher who dealt with behaviorism, let us say, before Plato? There are some, I think, that, I mean, to me, just the concept of behaviorism is not a product, just the name is the product of the American. But, I mean, the whole study goes back even to the Greek things. Do you have an idea about this?
Tell me what Greeks you have in mind here.
Well, I've been just reading the other day, before even Plato, they used the same thing. Us are, you know, stimuli, first ones.
You may be talking about some Greeks I don't know about, and I'm not an expert on the ancient Greek philosophers, but did they really have the methodological stance that you can't make any statements about the inner events as there is from observing the SR connections? See, but that's part of the behaviorist program, isn't it? It's not just that you start with studying the movements. In fact, in one sense, we are all behaviorists in this rather unexciting sense that the database, if we're studying a patient or a student, a subject, is what they say and do. I mean, I do not have direct access to your mental events, and I could be very strongly interested in your mental events. And as a clinician, I am interested in mental events. In fact, when I was running rats, I was interested in the rat's mind, which you weren't supposed to be. Although one of the great animal psychologists, one of the few women that got to be APA president in the old days, Margaret Floyd Washburn, always said that her interest was in the animal mind, and that the animal's learning and behavior and so on was her means of inferring what was going on in the animal's mind. There is a rather obvious sense in which we are all behaviorists, since our database is behavior. And even if you don't like the word stimulus because it sounds too atomistic, we do study the behavior by characterizing the stimulus field, right? Even if we characterize it in very molar ways. We're all behaviorists in that sense. What did you tell the subjects? Did you have them read it, or did you say it out loud? Somebody can ask about the illumination in the room, and all those things are statements about the impinging stimuli, even if they're highly configured and gestalted. So one should not connect behaviorism specifically with Watson's atomistic theory of learning. If you've read Tolman, and if you haven't read Tolman, do yourself a favor and read it. It's a terrific book. I reread it recently. It's a great book, one of the most exciting books I ever read when I was in graduate school. And you know, people keep reinventing the wheel, and you can save yourself some time if you go back and read some of those great guys. Yes, ma'am?
Well, it's just the thing that the question brought up was there's some things in Aristotle where he developed an association of principles. Is that correct?
It's all right to talk about Aristotle having an associationist idea of the mind, but I would object if you said it was a behaviorist idea of the mind. Historically, we shouldn't spend too much time on this today, but historically there was a correlation in the American tradition between what you could call atomism with regard to the units and behaviorism as a definition of the subject matter. Historically, that was true. But you can find the striking exception in somebody like Tolman, who was explicitly behavioristic, who even gave what we now see as phony operational definitions of mentalistic terms, in terms of running back and forth, for example. That glossary at the back of Tolman's book is a guy who really wants to know how the rat's mind is working, but thinks it's sinful. and consequently attempts to behaviorize because he was hooked on operational definitions. But Tolman is clearly not atomistic. Much of his book is a critique, including of Pavlov's experiments, is not that the dog was really expecting when he was slurping. He was expecting the goodie. That's what you were dealing with, said Tolman. Other people could be highly atomistic without being behavioristic, for example, some of the Titchenerians. Whereas the Gestaltists were neither atomistic nor behavioristic. So these two things are conceptually distinct, but they happen to have been intellectually correlated. In Watson's case, of course, a very atomistic way of going about it, and the belief that the rat learned the maze by hooking up his own proprioceptive backlash from his immediately preceding movements to the next movement. Not a dumb thing to have said, but that's an example of where you can do crucial experiments even in psychology. I mean, Watson's theory of proprioceptive conditioning was slain by two crucial experiments. Two. Just like Popper says. Two. Killed it. Number one, Lashley and Ball cut the dorsal columns. So the rat was like a guy with tabies, with syphilis of the columns of gall and burdock, and that meant that he wasn't getting any proprioceptive feedback. So there they were, stumbling around like a Tibetic. It took a long time, but the errors didn't increase very much. So they had, quote, learned how to go through the maze rather than learning a certain conditioned movement to their own previous movements. And about the same time, Ross McFarlane, I think it was, not sure of that site, in the 20s, taught rats a multiple unit Y maze, running through in the usual way, and then flooded it. Dumped the poor little things in, they had to swim. Well, that's very different proprioceptive feedback. And they swam okay, and their time was increased, and their errors increased a itty bit, but not very much. Conclusion, whatever it was they've learned, it ain't simply conditioning of their proprioception. Two crucial experiments. And, of course, the third one on humans that people can do. I've never read this one. McCorkadale told me about this one. People can do conceptual problems after being injected with curare in an iron lung so that they can't use their muscles. And if you're thinking with your muscles, which is what Watson believed, you know, somebody said John B. Watson has made up his windpipe. If you're thinking with your muscles, you wouldn't be able to do mathematical problems in your head when you're curarized. Well, I'm getting off the point. Thirdly, we had the movement of operationism, and that is associated with the name of Percy W. Bridgman, a Nobel laureate in experimental physics at Harvard. He wrote a book published in the late 20s, I can't remember, it's 28 or 29, called The Logic of Modern Physics, in which he said that the meaning of all of the terms of physics is given by the operations performed to measure them. And thus the meaning of the concept length is in terms of laying down meter sticks. Now, the interesting thing about operationism is that it was the social scientists that picked up Bridgman much more than the physicists and chemists did. I don't know what a Gallup poll would have shown, but there were many physicists who didn't buy Bridgman's thing, and it was criticized informally. In fact, the physicists didn't even bother writing very much about it. It was criticized enough, apparently informally or in correspondence, that in 1935 he wrote another book whose title I cannot recall, again on physics, in which he amended and watered down his 1929 position and included such things as conceptual and paper and pencil operations. Well, now if you allow conceptual operations, then you are immediately allowing the whole theoretical network, and then you have the question of whether the derivation chain goes from the theory to the facts and from the facts to the theory or only unidirectionally. And the fact is that in physics, as in all sciences, it mostly goes unidirectionally. The derivation chain that goes through logically and in the formalism is from the theory to the facts, but not backward. We'll harp on that through this course. And so, Bridgman's operationism, which worked okay for him because the area he worked in, was the experimental physics of high pressure. I mean, he was in the business of compressing gases and liquids and getting their temperatures down. And in that domain, I have to rely on what the experts tell me, in that domain you can squeak through pretty well with this kind of notion of theoretical constructs without getting into too much trouble. Not completely. As a physicist visitor to the center once said, even Bridgman in his field couldn't quite do it because the concept of temperature is a crucial part of his research area. And the theoretical concept of temperature, as I assume you all know, is not the reading of a thermometer. The concept of temperature in physics is the mean kinetic energy of the molecules. Don't press me on what it happens when they ain't moving anymore. We got to... Like so. Now, when we get them so they're not moving at all anymore, as I understand it, there's a little controversy about how we make the, how we do the redefining. But this thing is not equal to temperature in the thermometer sense. This thing is related to it, and that's why we can have arguments about whether, under what conditions you should use a gas thermometer, a mercury thermometer, an alcohol thermometer. And the other point that was made against Bridgman very early was that that makes physics be in an unsatisfactory state of affairs because nobody is ever going to stick a mercury thermometer into the sun. And that being so, it's embarrassing that big T, Kelvin temperature, does not mean the same thing when I've got a fever or in a bomb calorimeter or whatever as it does in astronomy. And that makes physics and chemistry quite unsatisfactory. So the Bridgman's thing didn't fly very well in his own discipline. But the psychologists and the sociologists became mesmerized by it. And if you're thinking with your muscles, you wouldn't be able to do mathematical problems in your head when you're curarized. Well, I'm getting off the point. Thirdly, we had the movement of operationism, and that is associated with the name of Percy W. The interesting thing about operationism is that it was the social scientists that picked up Bridgman much more than the physicists and chemists did. I don't know what a Gallup poll would have shown, but there were many physicists who didn't buy Bridgman's thing, and it was criticized informally. In fact, the physicists didn't even bother writing very much about it, but it was criticized enough apparently informally or in correspondence that in 1935 he wrote another book whose title I cannot recall, again on physics, in which he amended and watered down his 1929 position and included such things as conceptual and paper and pencil operations. Well, now if you allow conceptual operations, then you are immediately allowing the whole theoretical network, and then you have the question of whether the derivation chain goes from the theory to the facts and from the facts to the theory or only unidirectionally. And the fact is that in physics, as in all sciences, it mostly goes unidirectionally. The derivation chain that goes through logically and in the formalism is from the theory to the facts, but not backward. We'll harp on that through this course. And so Bridgman's operationism, which worked okay for him because the area he worked in was the experimental physics of high pressure. I mean, he was in the business of compressing gases and liquids and getting their temperatures down. And in that domain, I have to rely on what the experts tell me, in that domain you can squeak through pretty well with this kind of notion of theoretical constructs without getting into too much trouble. Not completely. As a physicist visitor to the center once said, even Bridgman in his field couldn't quite do it because the concept of temperature is a crucial part of his research area. And the theoretical concept of temperature, as I assume you all know, is not the reading of a thermometer. The concept of temperature in physics is the mean kinetic energy of the molecules. Don't press me on what it happens when they ain't moving anymore. We got to... Like so. Now, when we get them so they're not moving at all anymore, as I understand it, there's a little controversy about how we make the, how we do the redefining. But this thing is not equal to temperature in the thermometer sense. this thing is related to it, and that's why we can have arguments about whether, under what conditions you should use a gas thermometer, a mercury thermometer, an alcohol thermometer. And the other point that was made against Bridgman very early was that that makes physics be in an unsatisfactory state of affairs because nobody is ever going to stick a mercury thermometer into the sun. And that being so, it's embarrassing that big T, Kelvin temperature, does not mean the same thing when I've got a fever or in a bomb calorimeter or whatever as it does in astronomy. And that makes physics and chemistry quite unsatisfactory. So the Bridgman's thing didn't fly very well in his own discipline. But the psychologists and the sociologists became mesmerized by it. And they decided, in these sciences, like the social sciences, you know, we are frequently in rather bad shape as regards the subject matter, and we don't advance very rapidly, and theories have a half-life of fully 10 years. Freudians and Adlerians can continue to argue 85 years later and so forth. And it's a little embarrassing because we want to think of ourselves as scientists, and parts of what we do is middling scientific, and much of what we do is, what should we say, it's hardly in much better shape than the medieval history so far as being a real science is concerned. Don't misunderstand that remark. I got nothing against historians, and they aren't so damn pretentious as psychologists and sociologists. Some of them don't even want to be, they don't like to be counted as, quote, social scientists. They're in a different enterprise. They tell you that. And they fight like crazy, apparently, among themselves about the matter, especially the quantification question. We and the sociologists were mesmerized by Bridgman's book, and so that gave rise to the dogma of beginning psych and beginning soc, that all terms in psychology and sociology must be operationally defined. And the fact that the logicians were pointing out that the terms in the sciences that we admire so much, like chemistry and genetics and physics, are not all operationally defined, and that when they can be, it's because the theory has been elaborated to such a powerful degree that we have a very tight derivation chain between the theoretical entities and the observations. And that if you look at the history of those disciplines, in the early stages, they were not very operationally defined. If you look at the early Benjamin Franklin, electricity, and Faraday, you read any of that early stuff, and you think, oh, why, they would flunk their prelims using this language so carelessly and drawing these pictures and having these models and analogies and saying, well, let's see, is there only one kind of electrical fluid or are there two different kinds of fluids, etc. What a mess, scandalous. Well, that's the way the sciences begin. And so what the psychologist and sociologist has to do is give you pseudo-operational definitions. If he's hooked on operationism, he has to give you definitions that he says are operational. And what you do with somebody like that, it's not my advice to hit him with philosophy of science. That doesn't tend to work. What you do is wait around, let him talk further, and then trip him up. See, that's what you let him give his operational definition. Don't say, oh, I don't know that would, Carnap wouldn't like that. Let him give his operational definition and then let him talk some more. And you can always trip him up by showing that he isn't using it precisely in this rigorous way that he said. Try it out. Almost always works. Fourth big influence, the one that molded the psychologists of my generation very greatly. Took just taken me some years to get cured of this. And it wasn't too bad a disease. I mean, it does give you immunities to do some real bullshit. But it was an intellectual mistake. It was overdone, oversimplified. And that was logical positivism. Now, as I say, I resent it when the younger people beat up on these men as if they were fools, because they weren't. And what we do with logical positivism, unless we're grinding some axe, is to ask, what are the insights that they had, and what are the ways in which they overdid it? Which is what you do when you criticize a scientist 50 years later. Logical positivism is connected with a bunch in Vienna in the 20s, calling themselves the Vienna Circle. Der Wiener Kreis. And let me put down some of the names of these people. I will be referring to some of them off and on others I won't. The beginning of the movement was in approximately 1920, although they hadn't christened themselves with a name then. It was arrival there, taking up the chair that I believe had been held by the great physicist Ernst Mach, after whom Mach 1 and 2 is named. Moritz Schlick, who, while he was a philosopher by union card, was thoroughly familiar with a couple of sciences, to wit, physics and chemistry. Schlick was sort of the leader of the group because of his occupancy of this distinguished academic chair. He was assassinated by a paranoid student in 1936. But other people in the bunch were the logician Rudolf Carnap, and I'll be mentioning him frequently. He was more of a logician than he was a philosopher. In fact, he did not like being called a philosopher. In his later writings, he allows that term, but in his youth, he would tell people that I am a logician, a philosopher. That would mean somebody like Hegel who was full of baloney. Carnap's view of philosophy of science, for example, was that philosophy of science is the same as logic of science. And what is logic of science? Logic of science is nothing but the logical syntax of the language of science. Now, that's a pretty strong position. That means all you have to do is to take the books and parse the discourse. And no overarching epistemological or methodological things needed if you think clearly. He came away from that view in later years. If you want to put yourself to sleep, get a copy of his great book, 1934, called The Logical Syntax of Language, which I believe maybe Willard V. Quine has read, and I doubt that anybody else has. A mathematician named Hahn. A fellow named Gustav Bergman, still alive, professor at University of Iowa, used to teach the history of psychology class for the psych department there. Herbert Feigl, that I've mentioned, a friend of mine, died last year, founder of the Minnesota Center for Philosophy of Science. Another physicist named Philipp Frank. A strange, fascinating man named Otto Neurath that I never met. He was the only communist in the bunch. The rest of them were all social democrats. Whether he was a Stalinist or merely a Marxist, I don't know, but he just barely escaped from Vienna when the Anschluss took place in 1938. He would have got it in the neck for being A, a communist, and B, a Jew. Went to work in Holland, and then of course the Nazis went into Holland, and he escaped to England in a rowboat. He bribed a Dutch guy to row him across the English Channel, and fortunately it was a nice day. And Otto Neurath is particularly important because he was the founder of the International Encyclopedia of Unified Science, a terrific series still worth reading, in which Thomas Kuhn's Scientific Revolutions book, strangely enough, first appeared. Otto Neurath also was the one that used to reprove Feigl if he argued with theologians and metaphysicians, saying to him in German, I don't speak German, but in effect saying to him, Herbert, when are you going to learn you can only speak with people in the club? He was also famous for an analogy of science reconstructing itself as being a fellow floating on a raft, repairing the raft that he's floating on. And that's a nice analogy to how the thing goes. Contrast with Popper's science is piles sunk in a swamp. That's a nice one too. Felix Kaufmann, who was an economist or He may have even been trained as a lawyer.
Bergman had a law degree.
These were funny people. They knew about lots of different things. What they had in common was that they all adored science and thought that scientific knowledge was the essentially damn near the only kind of knowledge that there was, and that was the paradigm of knowledge, so that we should fix up epistemology so that we could defend that position. Then there were two other famous people who were in Berlin but maintained a connection with the Viennese and frequently visited them, Carl G. Hempel, for some reason known to his friends as Peter. I don't know where that came from. You were told he call him Peter, don't call him Carl. And Hans Reichenbach, whom I have mentioned. Those two were in Berlin. Well, this bunch began to meet regularly, once a week, in the middle 20s. They had irregularly had contacts from about 1921, and they began, at Feigl's suggestion, to meet regularly in the 20s in Vienna. And in 1929, they put out a manifesto. It was a real manifesto. I mean, it was like Marx and Engels. And it was called Wissenschaftliche Weltauffassung, the scientific, what, grasp of the world, or the scientific conception of the world. I'm not sure about Auffassung. It was a manifesto. They said what they were up to, just like Marx and Engels. They said their aim was twofold. One, to give a rational reconstruction of science . That notion of a rational reconstruction meant that you analyze it, and having analyzed it, you see how it could be justified. They were what Popper and his ilk called justificationists. They were hooked on Descartes, whereas Popper says once you get into Descartes' stove, you're cooked. Justificationism. We'll start with a few protocols that nobody who has normal vision and isn't insane or feeble-minded could dispute, and starting with those protocols will justify the scientific structure. And in 1928 or 9, Carnap wrote a book, for years not Englished, Logischer Aufbau der Welt, The Logical Construction of the World, in which he imagined a very simple knower with only one modality. He chose vision, since we're such a visual animal, and one primitive relation called Ähnlichkeitserinnerung, the remembrance of similarity, and a complicated formalism in which he tried to show. I mean, this is the obsessive character now of positivism. It's this urge for certainty that the philosophers have had all these years, like Descartes. What can't I possibly doubt, no matter how hard I try? that obsession that they have led Carnap to try to reconstruct the whole of ordinary knowledge of familiar everyday objects, and out of that other people's minds, behavioristically construed. And once you get other people, then they can be observing instruments for you, and that means you can find a lot about things about other fields without studying them yourself, and so it goes. This whole business on the basis of this primitive relationship, Ähnlichkeitserinnerung, the remembrance of similarity, meaning I've seen this pattern before, roughly. And he thought that by imposing some kind of a formalism upon the flux of your experiences, that you could reconstruct the whole world, animate and inanimate. It was a nice try, it didn't work. And he was particularly irritated because philosophers told him he was an idealist or a phenomenalist or an idealist. Whereas the idea of the Viennese was that we aren't any of those dumb things. We are not materialists. We are not idealists. We don't follow Hegel or Schopenhauer or Kant or any of these people because they all engaged in metaphysics even when they thought they weren't. And we don't do that. We engage in the careful logical analysis of scientific language. And none of those labels applies to us. Their first aim, then, was to analyze science and analyze it in such a way as that you could rationally reconstruct it, mean justify it. Show why a rational person should believe in chemistry. Why it shouldn't be just a matter of taste. Oh, I don't like chemistry. What you take is stuff that anybody who, as I say, is sane and a cooperative introspector will be forced to admit if he pays attention. And from then, by God, you put the logic and the math on top of those protocols and you almost coerce him to believe in science. Nice idea. Can't be done. Secondly, they had a negative aim, which was just as strong as the positive one, as Feigl has said to me many times. He used to say, you know, Miel, you can always tell a positivist professor by his negativist students. And that was the liquidation of metaphysics. And they were as passionate about killing metaphysics as they were about proving science, maybe even a little more so. And metaphysics included secular metaphysics, a la Hegel or Josiah Royce or whoever, and it included theology, the way they tried to make their peace with the church, which was more important to do in Vienna in those days, especially if you were a Jew, not to get the archbishop mad at you, because he had a lot of leverage on the university and God knows what. And the way they tried to make their peace with the church was to say, oh no, we don't think these theological statements are false, they're just meaningless. Needless to say, our Holy Mother, the Church, didn't take very well to that formulation, and even the Lutherans didn't. So, and they said, well, it has a certain kind of emotional meaning. I can hear it now over and over again. Certain emotional meaning, calling up certain images, which may be very fruitful for life. But, of course, no cognitive content. So, Jesus of Nazareth rose from the dead. Well, that makes you feel pretty good. That's all right. Good for you. Be my guest. But no cognitive content. The liquidation of metaphysics, the liquidation of theology, the liquidation of metaphysical components in social science. Thus, for example, one of the reasons that many of them were, while they were socialists, were not Marxists, unlike Neurath, was that they didn't buy in the labor theory of value, which is crucial in Marxist theory, and they thought that the labor theory of value was a metaphysical notion. I mean, a guy put in so much toil here, and there's this lump of gold, and it's got these many BTUs of labor, and they thought that's a metaphysical concept. The Austrians have got it better. One spin-off from this was somewhat regrettable, and that was the criterion of meaning that they set up in order to liquidate theology and metaphysics and the more unsavory parts of science. They said scientists have fallen for metaphysics too, and they said part of our scut work here is going to clean up the remnants of metaphysics that even sciences have, and that'll be better for science. But a spin-off was that the criterion of cognitive meaningfulness that they set up for this nefarious purpose liquidated ethics and aesthetics, or at least much of aesthetics. Now, the part of aesthetics that studies the correlation between the brightness of the paint and whether people get a charge, that's empirical psychology, and they said that's all right. But when you start talking about the value of a Picasso or something, then you get into metaphysics. And they didn't really want to liquidate ethics. It became a minor scandal in positivism, particularly after Hitler. A positivist didn't like to say, well, you like chocolate malts, I like vanilla. You think it's all right to put 6 million people in gas chambers? I don't fancy that. And they had the feeling that there ought to be a little more you can say about that than merely that it's my preference. Hitler's taste in gas chambers is different from mine. And having liquidated ethics by their meaning criterion, what were they going to say about this? Most of them preferred not to talk about it at all. Moritz Schlick, who was quite distressed about this, wrote a whole book called Problems of Ethics and tried to fix it up. And it's not a dumb book. I recommend it to you. It doesn't wash by my lights, but he tried to fix it up in kind of an instrumental way so that while you could have internal connections between ethical propositions, yet when it comes down to it, it is a motivational question. And training people up ethically is fundamentally not merely to teaching them the words, but teaching them to have the right emotional responses. And of course, if I recall correctly, Aristotle said that as well. So that the cognitive component of ethics would be certain internal connections of ethical statements. See, if I say, producing, let's take, suppose we have an ethical postulate that says producing pain for its own sake is intrinsically wrong. That's a plausible one. For its own sake, meaning not to help somebody with his toothache or not to condition the autistic kid, but just to produce pain, make a living creature hurt. You're just doing that because you like to make creatures hurt. If anything is intrinsically wrong, presumably that's an example of it. Well, then if you take that as an ethical postulate, then there are various other kinds of activities that you can derive, and you would say it's justifiable if you're a member of the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals to spend money agitating the legislature to forbid bear baiting and pit bull fights and et cetera, et cetera. So you would derive a further consequence about political action or economic action from this fundamental premise. But they still took the position that the fundamental premise did not have cognitive content. And the reason they were stuck with that, which I repeat, they didn't like, these were not mean fellows, mostly very nice men, the ones that I met, fine human beings, and by my lights, the right instincts about the world and society and human relations. But the reason they got into this bind was that they set up a meaning criterion. If you're going to, on the one hand, find what sentences are scientifically meaningful and consequently take out things that aren't, even in psychology, you might say, for instance, the question that some of the Titchenerians worried about, is one JND really equal to another? Well, many of the positivists said, now we'll save the psychologists from wasting all their breath on that because, as they usually put it, that's not a meaningful question at all. Is one JND really equal to another? Maybe if they reformulate it, they can do an experiment. But as it stands, it's not meaningful. Well, to screen out that stuff and to screen out things about the internal connections of the Trinity, you know, the procession of the Son and the spiration of the Holy Ghost and all of that stuff, to get rid of that, they found themselves setting up a criterion for meaning, for cognitive meaning. Keep in mind, they always had emotional meaning over here. That's peachy keen. You can have all the emotions you want. It's a free country. As long as you know you're talking nonsense. See? Really a strange position. And the criterion was that a statement is cognitively meaningless if you do not know how you can verify it. It led to an affirmative form that you can find in Schlick, namely, and I think in Weismann somewhere, the meaning of a sentence is the method of its verification. Now, that doesn't follow from the first statement. They didn't claim it did. The first statement is a criterion of meaningfulness, and then the other one is a statement of the affirmative meaning, and those are connected, but you can't deduce the one from the other, and they realize that. But they made this mistake after first stating the verifiability criterion of meaning as an exclusion device to throw out metaphysics and theology, and unfortunately ethics, then they formulated the positive statement that the meaning of a statement is the method of its verification. Well, if you ask how you verify an ethical statement, if two people have different ethics, what kind of facts or observations can they collect in order to decide? As you all know, if you've taken a course in undergraduate course, even in ethics, that turns out to be damn near undoable. If you read current discussions about the good society, say John Rawls' theory of justice, which some people have compared with Aristotle's ethics. If you haven't read that, I recommend it to you. And then the libertarian reply, Nozick, also at Harvard, Anarchy, State, and Utopia. Well, when I read those two guys, I'm converted by the last one I read. And that's very common in ethical disputes. I mean, it's extremely hard as we get down to the rock bottom, primary ethical postulates, to do anything but say, well, what's the matter with you? You don't have the right ethical intuitions. I mean, what's the matter? Don't you see that this is a clear case? Huh? I don't see anything wrong with that. Huh? And I can't imagine how a conversation goes between Rawls and Nozick. They're both at Harvard. Whether they talk with each other or not, I don't know. But with this meaning criterion, since you couldn't figure out any way to verify an ethical proposition, for one thing, because the word wrong is not a predicate, a descriptive predicate like the word red or heavy or charged or fluid or frangible or even stupid. I mean, it's not that kind of a word. And the moral philosophers all agree that it's not that kind of a word. It's a funny kind of word, isn't it? I mean, in what domain are things wrong? I mean, what kind of a predicate is wrongness? You start thinking about that, and you get buggy after a while. It's not that it's only in ethics that it arises. It arises in pure mathematics, too. Similar problem arises in pure mathematics. If I ask, is Goldbach's conjecture true? Every even number can be written as the sum of two primes. Nobody's ever proved that. With the big computers now, they run it out. I don't know how to what extent. And practically all mathematicians believe in it. Almost all mathematicians believe in Fermat's last theorem. And that's been run out. Many special cases have been decided. Now, suppose the sun burns out before any mathematician proves or disproves Goldbach's conjecture. Then, leaving out the big committee in the sky, in what sense is Goldbach's conjecture valid? No proof is developed before the last mathematician dies. In some sense, is it still valid, and in what domain? Where is the Platonic heaven in which the numbers live, in which Goldbach's conjecture is true? That's the kind of question that led the great logician Kurt Gödel, of Gödel's theorem fame, to be a Platonist. He was a Platonist about numbers. Numbers were real. He said he didn't know where the hell they were, but they're in some numerical heaven. God knew whether Goldbach's conjecture was true or not. Yes, ma'am.
Well, I just had a question about what the criteria is. Strictly empirical
or informal disciplines, a logical deduction. You had two kinds. I'm glad you raised that question, though. I should have added, pure mathematics that's not applied, like applied geometry, to real space. There, you verified by deducing. You had the laws of the, you had the rules of the formal game, what they call the formation rules and the transformation rules. And the formation rules tell you when an expression is well formed, generally written by the logicians as WFF, without dots, usually italics, and pronounced woof, like a dog. You have a woof, you have rules for when an expression is a woof, and then you have rules that tell you when, given a set of woofs, another woof can be validly written down, said to be deducible from them or follow from them. The first is called formation rules, and the second is called transformation rules. And that was it. That defines a formal calculus. And you verify statements in a formal calculus by showing that you can get one woof from a previous set of woofs in accordance with the transformation rules. And the idea was that you could do this without having any understanding of what the notation was about. That wasn't their idea. That concept that you should need to have no understanding of what you were referring to goes back before the positivists to the great mathematician Hilbert, Ackermann, Bernays, and fellows like that. They were aware that there were fallacies in Euclid's proofs, sad to relate. Almost ruined Bertrand Russell's adolescence, he says, when he realized that even geometry wasn't certain. And the idea was we're going to fix Euclid so that you can prove all of the provable theorems in Euclid without knowing whether the notation X, Y, Z, P, L, and so on talks about lines or points or anything else. And that was their program. So there were two ways of verifying. One was the formal manipulation that applied to pure calculi like logic and set theory and mathematics. And the other was the empirical world, physical things, other people, and so forth. Now, there was some tendency to say that the formal business, you didn't have to have a meaning criterion, because if you believed the early Wittgenstein, theorems of logic and set theory and mathematics were tautologies, and one way of looking at tautologies was that they had no content. So they had one way of saying that the only domain in which we can be absolutely certain is a domain in which we don't know what we're talking about, as Bertrand Russell said, namely the formal notation manipulated according to the rules of the game. Now, the notion that the meaning of a statement is the method of its verification was fairly quickly abandoned. Partly by considerations from the sciences, like the temperature example, the temperature of the sun and the temperature of my kid's fever and the temperature of the hot soup. And they really didn't want to say that the concept temperature was different, but the method of verification was different, and not only for technological reasons. It wasn't you hadn't been clever enough to make a good enough thermometer to stick in the sun, right? I mean, it violates the laws of physics to stick a thermometer into the sun. A common sense example will take care of this easy, so let me use it. Take the sentence, Caesar crossed the Rubicon. Common in logic books. Caesar crossed the Rubicon. I assume for the moment that we do understand the meaning of Rubicon. It's a certain river in the north of Italy, blah, blah, blah. And we understand the meaning of Caesar. I don't want to argue the semantics of names. So you understand Caesar, and you understand the Rubicon, and you understand the English verb to cross. And now I say Caesar crossed the Rubicon. Now, what is the evidence? What is the method of verification for you and me? For most of us, we rely on authority, as Bertrand Russell says. Most of what we believe is on authority, even though that's called the argumentum ad verecundiam in the logic book. Obviously, you believe almost all of the things you read in the Britannica on authority. The only question is how to calibrate the authority, right? We figure if it's in the Britannica, somebody calibrated it for us. Not always true. Whereas if it's from a politician, I tend to put no credence in it, either party. Now, the method of verification for the historian, who's the authority that I have to rely on in reading a history book, it says Caesar crossed the Rubicon, and he quotes from the Gallic War and this and that and other writers. His data go back to, I believe, the earliest manuscript that bears on this is a 9th century manuscript in the Vatican Library. And if he can get permission, he can go in and look at that. That's 1,000 years after Caesar crossed it. That's the database. And if we press the point, like Carnap or Descartes, wanting to get back to the rock-bottom protocol, that's as far as we can go. 9th century manuscript. Now, a Roman centurion sitting on a horse next to Caesar as he crossed believed that Caesar crossed the Rubicon. There is no overlap between his verification base and ours. It's not just that it's incomplete, they're partial. There's zero overlap, right? Our raw data, so far as we have anything you could call raw, is this palimpsest here that's in the Vatican Library. And we have no way to get back and get the sound waves and recapture them of Caesar saying, what the hell, the die is cast, let's do it, or something. And so we're stuck with this set of data, no matter how complicated and ramified. I mean, we can do carbon dating on that manuscript. We can do all this stuff to decide how much we can trust it. But it's got zero overlap from the standpoint of the experience base with this Roman centurion. So if one says that the meaning of a statement is the method of its verification, then when you say that Caesar crossed the Rubicon and the Roman centurion said Caesar crossed the Rubicon, you and the centurion believe totally different things. Now, we don't mind saying you believe a little different, see Osgood and Such and the semantic differential and so on, but to say that they believe totally different things, if the meaning of a sentence is the method of verification, and if the verification base is disjoint, then there's no overlap between your belief in that proposition and the Roman centurion's, and that's pretty goofy, and nobody wanted to be stuck with that, even the Vienna Circle. So they abandoned the definition. They tried to fix up the verifiability criterion of meaning, but they dropped this business that the meaning is the method of verification. For common sense reasons like the Caesar, and for scientific reasons like the temperature concept. The meaning criterion was set forth forcefully by a book that was being avidly read by all the bright undergraduates with philosophical interests when I was a student in the late 1930s, Alfred J. Ayer. Still a fun book to read. Language, Truth, and Logic, 1936, first edition. Freddie Ayer, as he's known, now Sir Alfred. Freddie Ayer went briefly to Vienna, hung around and drank coffee with the Vienna Circle, and came back and became world famous overnight writing Language, Truth, and Logic. And I remember struggling with this as a freshman because it keeps saying in chapter 1, well, you'll see in chapter 7 where we prove the verifiability criterion, and then chapter 3, as will be found in chapter 7 where we prove the verifiability criterion. And then you get to chapter 7 and you can't find exactly what you would call a, quotes, proof of the verifiability criterion. And I remember my friend George Collier, now professor of psychology at Rutgers, expert on hunger and thirst drives, and I going through this Talmudically, trying to find the text where the verifiability of my criterion is, quote, proved, which it ain't. And Freddie Ayer today would be the first to admit that it's not, he didn't prove it, nor is it the kind of thing one can prove. By the time Feigl came here in 1940 from Iowa, he was no longer speaking of it really as something you tried to prove anyway, but he said, well, it's what you could call a persuasive definition. Meaning, I will invite you, come on, let's define it this way, because it was becoming generally known that you couldn't prove it, and if you even stated it in a way that was good enough, incisive enough, powerful enough to throw out theology and metaphysics, it threw out parts of science. And they worked on it. These guys were smart, they worked hard. The best criticisms did not come from the outside, by the way. The best criticisms of logical positivism came from within. They had about 30 IQ points on the outside critics, with certain exceptions, like Brand Blanchard, his book, that's a good attack. But by and large, the outsiders didn't threaten them very much. But they realized that this didn't quite work, and they kept trying to fix it. A logician church showed something wrong with Freddie Ayer's way of defining an empirical sentence. So in the second edition, Freddie Ayer fixed it up, and logician church showed what was wrong with that one, and Ayer threw in the sponge. The last attempt to give a definition of a meaning criterion appears in Minnesota Studies for the Philosophy of Science, which is on the reading list, Volume 1, Carnap making a last heroic attempt to give a definition of the meaning criterion. And he does it in a very clever way, being a logician of first order. He defines the meaningfulness of concepts via their being in a string of statements that terminate in a verifiable observation. And then when he's shown that a certain concept is meaningful because it appears in such a string, now it becomes kosher to form sentences with that concept in. That was a good move. That was clever. So we move from sentence meaning to concept meaningfulness back to sentence meaningfulness, you see. If the concept libido appears in some string, even one pitiful little strand to one of Freud's observations as in the derivation chain, then libido is at least itty-bitty interpreted, partially interpreted, they call it. So that I have a little bit of empirical meaning to libido. Now I can formulate statements about libido and cathexis and so on, and they may not terminate in something observational, but they are meaningful because they meet the rule. So it's a way of doing sentence empiricism via concept empiricism via sentence empiricism. Bertrand Russell, who was the spiritual grandfather or father of the bunch, Bertrand Russell objected from the first. He said, allowing for vagueness, which is true in all human language, including scientific language, allowing for vagueness, Bertrand Russell said, if I know the grammar of a language and I know the meaning of the individual words in a sentence and they don't violate the grammar, then I know what the sentence says, whether I can verify it or not. Not a bad position. Not a bad position. You obey the laws, the grammatical laws. There are some others you could call semantical constraints that are not matters of grammar, the kind that Chomskyites like to talk about, like adjectives rush furiously as meaningful, but not on syntactical, but on semantical grounds. But Russell's position was that the criterion of meaningfulness didn't do justice to this sort of common sense position. If I know what the words mean, more or less, not precisely, if I know what the words mean, and you put them together in a grammatically formed sentence into a woof, then, damn it, I know what the sentence means, more or less. And if I can't test it by some observation, well, that just means there are some things that I can understand that I can't find out whether they're true or not, like Goldbach's conjecture or Fermat's last theorem, maybe. Well, now I'm up to Sir Karl Popper, and he's so special, and we're 3 minutes from the end, so I think we should quit today, and we'll take Popper up next time.